Welcome to Merely Catholic with me, Gavin Ashenden. Each of us has our own vocation, each of us our own calling. Part of Peter Hitchens' vocation is to tell the truth to the willfully deaf and delusional, as well as those who want to make use of a prophetic analysis of our human, cultural and political condition. But he's not much thanked, and it's a burden he has to bear that as society becomes increasingly self-destructive and determined to prefer being entertained to discovering the truth, his realism can begin to sound like pessimism. It was T.S. Eliot who famously reminded us that humankind cannot bear much reality, and so Peter is not courting popularity. He's starkly realistic about the untrustworthiness of politicians and the danger and duplicity of the state. No one would want to take up the cudgels for the other side of that debate, and yet, even so, the election of Giorgia Meloni to lead a coalition government in Italy has produced a rare moment in European politics. She's made her own the rhetoric of Christian values, and is one of the very few politicians in Europe not only to articulate opposition to the left's ideological war of terror, adopting Christian language to do so, but also to win power, however briefly. Peter Hitchens declines to be comforted by this, and whilst I find some reassurance that the fog of unreality has been pierced in the public space, even only for a brief moment, he's more cautious. In the conversation that follows, Peter sets out to school me in a more sober realism, and I try, not very successfully, to lighten the burden of his awareness of the approaching doom. Some listeners will be convinced by Peter's pragmatism, and others will join me in allowing ourselves a moment of encouragement, however fleeting, and even when provided by a politician. At the same time, we had no difficulty in agreeing about the cowardice of the churches in the face of secularisation and their apostasy in response to the challenge of the culture wars. The leaders of the churches are not much complimented, with the exception of Justin Welby being given credit for at least telling some of the truth in the public space, even if it took the death of a queen to do it. His sermon in Westminster Abbey provided a welcome moment of truth-telling, as he took a break from his more usual role, as Peter pithily puts it, best described by Aldous Huxley in Brave New World as arch community songster. Hope versus realism, faith versus the state, body versus the soul, light versus dark, Bunyan, St. Augustine and Vaughan Williams all found their way into our discussion. You can decide whereabouts on the scale that stretches between hope and realism you want to place yourself, as Peter Hitchens offers his unique and much-valued perspective on the state of the Church, the human condition, and the quest for salvation. And he joins me now. Peter Hitchens, thank you very much for joining me today. It's a great pleasure to meet you, and I'm very glad for an opportunity to talk together. And we're talking only days after the election of Giorgia Meloni. It seems to me that this is quite an important moment and a useful moment to be talking. I know you don't do optimism, you do realism, but what has her election done for you in terms of the scale of things as the left and the right fight it out for civilization in Europe?
Not much, I'm afraid. I'm worried, as I almost always am with continental, supposedly conservative politicians, by the long-standing historical links with movements of the fascist right. I think her organisation, and indeed her early political experience, is far too close to the MSI, which I remember very much as being a Mussolini offshoot when it began. I think that one of the problems with democracy at this stage, especially in countries which have handed over a lot of the authority to the European Union, is that it's a series of spasms of people saying we would like sentimentally various things to happen. We will therefore vote for parties which in Italy seem to arise and disappear almost as quickly as the weather changes, which promises this. But whether there's any possibility of this new prime minister and this new government actually doing anything substantial of the sort that I would like to see, I very much doubt. I had this problem as well with the enthusiasts for Mr. Orban in Hungary. There are things about him which are obviously laudable, but I'm afraid you have to remember that he doesn't seem really to be a friend of freedom. And I'm very attached to freedom. I don't think you can really separate it from politics or say that it doesn't matter or chuck it to one side. So I do fear a bit of that aspect. I'm happy to be proved wrong, but I'll be interested to see just how long this coalition endures and how able it is, given Italy's economic political and diplomatic position to do much of what it promises.
I share your hesitation about a passing government in one of the many coalitions in Italy achieving very much in practice. But two things, I think. One is, I'd like to pursue what you think the threat of fascism might be, given her inheritance from Mussolini. But more, just before we say that, you said you doubted she'd do any of the things you'd like to see done. What are the things you'd like to see done?
Well, I think what my principal desire in all politics is for there to be an end, at the very least, to the attack on the married family, which has been one of the most distinguishing factors in, I think, every European country since 1945, at an increasing pace. I don't mean the promotion necessarily of other ways of living, but the actual removal of the props and stays which have kept the married family, and the idea that parents bring up their own children from surviving in a strong state. And one of the problems with politics is that it's an elevation of political power to a greater height than it deserves. And also, it promotes the power of the state. When you give your vote to somebody who offers you fantastic things, then you're actually tending to increase the power of the state. And the power of the state operates in competition with the rival power of the family. They are the two great rivals, it seems to me, of most domestic politics. I would be surprised, for instance, if the laws and social benefits and all the other things which once protected marriage as a unique institution were much stronger at the end of this government than they were at the beginning.
I dare say you're right. I mean, it would be wonderful if they were. And given the way in which politics and politicians ineptly stumble from one disaster to another, you're probably right.
The simple point about this, in the case of Meloni herself, is not married to a partner who I believe is also the father of her child. Now, that's her freedom, but it's a very important symbolic fact about her and her government. If she doesn't herself believe in it for herself, then what can we expect of her government in protecting those who do believe very strongly?
That's certainly true. Christianity has had often to deal with benign fellow travellers rather than ideal pilgrims or would-be saints. And obviously she's in the category of the benign fellow traveller. And the Catholic Church, above all institutions, is dedicated to the family in precisely the ways you've described. There's no great danger from fascism at the moment. In real terms,
I'm not suggesting that there is. There is, I think, a general danger to liberty from many, many directions. I just think that anybody who's prepared to associate or align themselves with a movement which is historically linked to somebody of the character and quality of Benito Mussolini has to be suspect. This is something which I think any civilized person must wholly reject, the idea of a government fundamentally upheld by violence and lawlessness, which Mussolini was, and also, certainly in its later stages, deeply implicated in racial murder. I know that there was some resistance to that from Mussolini, but not enough. And that was one of the most discredited regimes of modern times. It would seem to me that if you were planning to walk a straight path in modern politics, you really couldn't have anything to do with such movements. And you look at both the Le Pen movement in France and organizations like the Flux Bloc in the Netherlands, and you see this unwillingness to cut themselves off from origins which, to people like me, just seem to be impossible. And if you won't rule that out in the past, what will you not rule out in the future? It would seem to me a reasonable test.
I can't disagree with what you're saying, because it's perfectly reasonable and it's true, but it seems to be more a matter of context. I mean, you're absolutely right. That's the historical trajectory. Those are the roots. They're dangerous and it's a poisoned well. However, isn't there a danger sometimes also of guilt by association? Aren't we entitled to take her at her word when she goes out of her way to say to Israel, I'm entirely not Semitic, I'm pro-Israel, and when she goes out of her way to say, I want to practice liberty for the individual, and uses a kind of language that's entirely congruent with a Christian view of the sanctity of human life. I mean, is it fair to weigh the historical and political and ideological antecedents against what she says in public till she contradicts herself?
You can't keep this sort of thing out of your past. And you're not willing to keep it out of your past. And if you've arisen from a background that suggests that whatever you may say, you might have some attachment to it, then I think we have to take that into account. And I will not be optimistic about such movements. I can't be. I think it's unwise and wrong. I have to stand aside from it. It's not not really about possibility for me to, in my own country, to vote for or support such a tendency, or in any other country to give it any sort of endorsement or place any faith in it.
Okay, so let's not, we're not going to endorse it, and you and I don't have the vote in Italy, that's true.
Well, it's true, but nonetheless, what we say lasts forever and has importance and will be remembered, and what we think should be the same as what we say. This is what I think, and I think that those of us who are committed, as I am, to freedom under the law is the best way of managing a society, you have to be very suspicious of those who seem to have doubts about that.
So we do. And that level of suspicion is one of the things that operates as a guardian of our freedoms, and it shouldn't be diluted one jot. However, it's a bit like two sides of a coin, I think. The other side of the coin is there are very few public voices in European or international politics which come remotely near using the language of Christendom. And so for someone to say, I want to support those who believe in God and the integrity of their country instead of multiculturalism and the family instead of the state, shouldn't that operate as some kind of rallying cry for us? Not politically, in the sense that we're going to ally ourselves to her political aims. Anyway, they're Italian, not English. But just in terms of rejoicing that somebody has broken through the surface of the frozen ice of the left in order to use a kind of language that will encourage what might or might not be the silent majority.
I'm so sorry, but if I were trying to create a majority or a plurality in a country such as Italy, then this is just something that I would almost certainly do. Not when I say it's inconceivable for me to be involved, but if I were a politician trying to do that, then these would be words I would speak. The question is, do we believe them? Do they mean anything? Or are they just adopted? And Evelyn Waugh said long ago that politicians adopted positions so as to pursue office rather than pursuing office so as to fulfill political aims. And I think this is the thing you have to take into account. I've spent too much time too close to politicians to be trustful of them. And the broader and more glorious their promises are, the faster I count the spoons.
Well, that's quite right. I've no argument with that at all.
You're not getting me on this. I'm sorry. I will not do it.
No, we shouldn't have to. On the other hand, if we go to the church, for example, the church has its own civil war. Parts of the church have been hugely, unfortunately, over-associated with the right in the 20th century, and other parts equally, unfortunately, over-associated with the left. But at the moment, the threat is not from the right. The threat is from the ideological left, which is explicitly anti-Christian. Can't we take any hope from a public figure, however corrupt they may or may not be, suspicious they may or may not be, from somebody who uses our language and allows us to coalesce around...
I can't stop you, but you can't make me. Satanic optimism, I think you're suffering from it.
So if you think I'm over-optimistic and
at the very least, you're obliged, it seems to me, in the light of human experience, to wait and see a little longer than this before you get too enthusiastic. This is a government. The leader of this government is not on her own. She rivals are breathing down her neck. The members of parliament who will form her coalition are ambitious politicians. She has to cope with the Italian media and the forces such as Berlusconi, which are always present. What she actually does, once she has the rather feeble levers of office which Italian politics grants, will be perhaps quite different from what she says she was going to do, or even from what she thought she was going to do. And at that point, you have to depart from Britain Manifesto commitments, and the road becomes hard to see. Instincts and background become important.
I endorse everything you say. I completely agree with you. You're exercising a level of political realism that has been forged out of hard experience. But I'm not trying to persuade you to endorse her political program as an Italian coalition politician. In one sense, much as I love Italy and Italians, that's not where my first concerns lie. What I'm excited about and inspired by is a public figure who quotes Chesterton and appears to mean it, because one of the biggest problems we face is not a politician on the make in the coalition government in South Europe, but an ideological warfare that we're losing because people are not able to stand in the public space and call a spade a spade. Hasn't she done that?
Well, no, Christians shouldn't be so desperate about the hostility of politics towards them that they grasp at any straw. Quoting G.K. Chesterton, that doesn't necessarily mean that they're your friend. Indeed, G.K. Chesterton has, how shall I put this, some serious faults to be reckoned with. So I just don't get it. Among the most important words spoken by our Lord is, my kingdom is not of this world. Great danger, and as I say, I do call it idolatry, is a great danger in pinning too much faith in politics and putting too much trust in individual politicians. For Christians, we have, I think, increasingly to manage on our own in a society which is not merely secular, but increasingly anti-religious. And we're going to have to find some way of coping with that. The Christian churches in Western Europe have, for a very long time, lived in luxury with governments which have by and large endorsed them. This wasn't necessarily what anybody would have expected when our religion was founded. And indeed, it had to struggle greatly to begin with to be allowed to exist at all. I don't think that we should underestimate the need to rearrange, recalibrate our attitudes towards the state and towards politics. And not to assume that we're looking at a group of politicians among whom we might find some friends, but much rather say we're living in a state in which almost every aspect of the state, from the schools to the transport system, is actually hostile to us.
So let not my enthusiasm for Chesterton or even a breakthrough in non-left politics give the impression that I'm trying to hoist the fate of the church to a political project. I'm not, and I agree with what you said. How should the Christian churches cope in this ideological war in which the pressures on Christendom and Christian values are unremitting and never honest? They clothe themselves with ethical virtues that they don't possess. How should the churches cope in this present situation that we're facing?
Well, how does one cope in a landscape in which one is surrounded by enemies or potential enemies? There's great caution.
But indeed, moving from caution, one of the things we have to do, if we can, is to reclaim some form of ideological clarity. I think one of the reasons why I was quite excited by her election was that I haven't really heard a politician, apart from Orbán, perhaps, and as you rightly say, there are reasons for being hesitant about him too, but I haven't really heard many politicians, particularly in the context of the EU, talk in terms of wanting to validate human and liberal democratic freedoms against the state.
I think perhaps there's been talk of that kind in Poland.
Yes.
But that has also run into some political complexity.
Well, my friends in Poland tell me that they think the culture wars are balanced in a kind of Brexit-like proportions, 58-52-48. They're not at all confident of pushing back against the progressive ideology that has swept throughout the rest of Europe. So, I mean, the polls...
Well, I think you will find that religious language recognisable to you and me is spoken in Polish politics.
So how can we persuade people who speak on behalf of the church and whose faith and politics are at least congruent with each other to find some greater clarity in articulating what the ethical issues are for our society?
Well, I think we have to return to the absolute original. The most profound issues are going to be increasingly for us as individuals with our consciences, because we cannot expect to have any help from the state in pursuing what we believe to be good. And that is going to be our experience. And there will be, quite possibly, the so-called Rod Dreher Benedict option will open up for many people. There will be a feeling that it might be wise to retreat in many ways from a society which is largely corrupt.
Well, that's no surprise to me. Just before we went, I pressed the record button. I mentioned that we both had experience of the Soviet Union, I think, in the 70s and me in the early 80s. And that's exactly what we found. We found groups of individual and corporate believers who, as Solzhenitsyn said, didn't live by lies and who tried their very best to live up to their consciences. Do you share Dreher's view that really the public battle is lost politically and culturally, and all we can do is prepare for a wasteland future where we gather in corners, quietly together, just to celebrate our faith and to live lives of integrity?
That's the way it looks to me. I look at allegedly conservative politics in my own country, in the United States, and I see really what is no more than feminism, liberalism. It's not socially or morally conservative at all. And I look at the state of conservative thought, which it tends to be a mixture of people who want to cut taxes or to start wars. And I don't recognize that as conservatism. And I don't see any major allies in any of the conservative movements that are visible to me who really understand the nature of this or whose motivation is fundamentally Christian.
It's been very difficult for people who've been trying to tell the truth, as you have been doing with some success in this. At least you have a platform and people read you and listen to you. But there have been other conservative voices who've been trying to say the same thing with less success. But it's been very difficult to persuade people of the danger that they're in. Is it, do you think, that people don't want to be free, that they don't want a level of personal autonomy, that they're prepared to give it up, as Huxley suggested in Brave New World, for a drug-ridden easy life? Is that the moral issue that's led to the acceleration of this crisis?
I don't doubt it. I think any serious person admits that he or she must be tempted by this. And pleasure is very attractive. The handing over responsibility is very attractive. And most people become slaves because fundamentally they don't really mind that much becoming slaves. And what Huxley was predicting, his exact words in the preface to the second edition of Brave New World, was that his fear was that men would learn to love their own servitude. And I think that many people do love their own servitude and are baffled by the idea that any other way of life would even appeal to me. Sometimes when I'm doing debates, for instance, on the legalization of drugs, I encounter people whose idea of morality and of human freedom and indeed dignity and the purpose of life is so utterly different from mine that I'm not really able to speak the same language to them. Although we share English technically, it means different things to them from what it means to me. And this is more common than you might think, and it goes together with a great deal of conformism. People love to be safe in a crowd. And why not? Those of us who ever step out of the crowd and immediately get pelted with slime realize that it can be quite difficult to do and not particularly attractive. I don't blame people for this. If we're going to offer them an alternative, we're going to have to do an awful lot better than the established churches of Western countries, which for the most part offer nothing at all.
Well, I was going to ask you about that. I mean, again, I agree with your diagnosis. And I mean, the extraordinary experience of COVID-19, which I don't think even in my most pessimistic moments I had conceived of taking place, only strengthens your argument. What can we say? Is there anything we can say to the leaders of the established churches? I don't want to be rude about the Anglicans whom I've left, and the Catholic hierarchy have yet to show themselves much more energetic in defense of Christian freedom. Do we just accept the fact that the institutions have been corrupted by past success? Or what role do you see the church is playing in trying to help individuals pursue the kind of ethics that we think are so essential to living a life of integrity?
Well, I think the problem is, for a large part, the church has made its peace with secular society. It's not dangerous enough to secular society. And it was quite interesting watching the Archbishop of Canterbury preaching at the Queen's funeral last week, because he actually did express some Christian sentiments, which in his mouth were very shocking to me, because I don't think I've ever heard him do it before. And I think a lot of people sat and listened and thought, good heavens. But I think only an occasion such as that, the funeral of the Queen, would lead him to do so. Generally, what the Anglican Church does, and it's not the only church which does this by any means, is it seeks the political kingdom and attempts to influence it. And the great settlement of 1945 in this country was hugely supported by people such as William Temple, who believed that you could actually more or less implement the Sermon on the Mount via Clement Attlee. And they had a very good go at it. And as we see, it didn't turn out quite as expected. But there is a strong confusion in the minds of many people. And there are exceptions to this. And we all know, everybody who has any contact with Christian churches know very good priests and ministers and very fine lay people who are not like this at all. And I absolutely accept everything that's criticism. I was applying them to them. But the truth is that these organizations seek above all political influence. And also they have abandoned, in a very peculiar but understandable way, they've abandoned some of the politically unattractive aspects of religion. So for instance, the whole idea of penitence, which is very, very strong in the traditional worship of the Church of England, has been more or less wiped out. It's much too matey. And it doesn't challenge people. And people actually don't go to church to get what they get on the arches. They go to the church to get something completely different. And when they get there and they find nothing but blandness, I think in many cases they're disappointed. But I had a long struggle in my own church when I returned to it in the 1980s to try and strengthen and restore the 1662 prayer book, with which you're no doubt familiar. And I thought to begin with that I was just surrounded by people with tin ears who had no liking for poetry and simply were a bit dim. But then I realized that it went much deeper than that. It's about the message of it, and particularly the theology of penitence, which is very, very strong in Troutman's prayer book, and which is very, very weak in the modern redesigned prayers, hymns, and everything else that we put up with. And even the Bible, and it's the reason I think why the King James Version is increasingly not used, it contains so many haunting. And when I say haunting, I don't mean, that was a nice piece of music, but haunting in the sense that we listen to it and think, do they mean me? So many phrases which disturb immensely the ordinary secular person living his secular life with the possibility that eternity might actually be rather a dangerous place. The power of it is so great that that's why they put it on a shelf in the back and they don't use it anymore. They don't, the full strength and power of religion is not attracted to them. And indeed, they regard it as dangerous. They want to be locked up in a box and perhaps got out a couple of times a year to be looked at and then quickly put back again in case it affects people.
I mean, you certainly described the zeitgeist, and I suppose it's been clear to many of us for a number of years that hierarchy have believed that providing people with entertainment rather than a path towards purity is the way to grow the church. But presumably one thing you'd say to them is you can't grow the church in these circumstances. What you need is a core group of people who take it seriously.
Growth is not a possible option at the moment. I mean, there are big, well-attended churches, but they tend to be very strongly, they have the aspect of social clubs and community singers. I would remember the priests in Huxley's Brave New World are actually called community songsters, and the Archbishop of Canterbury, replaced by a character called the Arch Community Songster of Canterbury. There is an element of this in some modern worship, which I feel it's slightly cruel to say it, but are they actually gathering for the consideration of the gospel and the worship of Christ, or is it much more of a social and self-reassuring occasion? They do no doubt a great deal of charitable good and all kinds of other things, but is it really what those churches were built to do?
Well, Cardinal Ratzinger shares your outlook, and I think in the late 70s, he wrote a fairly famous phrase where he warned, inconceivably at the time, but now perfectly conceivably, that the Catholic Church, despite the fact it had 1.4 billion members across the world, was going to find itself experiencing a time of purification. And that purification would mean a huge loss of numbers, and in the end, produce a church where people did act in accordance with their beliefs in the way that you suggested. So presumably, just at this point in history, that's what we should expect.
Well, again, you look at the Roman Catholic Church's great difficulty in finding new to enter its priesthood. It does seem to me to be in a very serious crisis in the countries where historically it's been extremely strong. Such as Germany as well, it seems to be the strength appears to be increasingly looser. So very large organizations can actually quite quickly fall into grave decline. And things which appeared a week ago to be tremendously powerful and unshakable can fall to pieces. And the biggest example of that, of course, in my lifetime and yours as well, is the Soviet Union, which until it fell, seemed totally impregnable, and now is nothing more than a heap of rust, gone from the minds of men. And Earth's proud empires pass away, as the hymn says, and sometimes more quickly than you think. Everything is in danger. It's particularly in danger from the Cultural Revolution, which is a Kierkegaardian Cultural Revolution, in which all the buildings remain standing, but the ideas which sustained them have been swept away. So people are reassured by what still stands around them. But then when they actually examine it, they find it isn't actually what it used to be at all.
I think the Gospels are congruent with the point of view. You know, Lord, how many will be saved? Take the narrow path. Very few are inclined to take the narrow path. Most want the broader path of entertainment. I mean, Christianity in itself is sympathetic with your fairly gritty view of human nature.
problem with that is the people who say that usually think they're going to be the ones who are saved, whereas I don't have to stress that this is not my attitude at all. I think we're all in deep trouble.
I'm absolutely certain we're in deep trouble. And the only thing that keeps one keen in the Christian life is a sense of exactly how much trouble one's in.
The wonderful part of the confession of Holy Communion about the remembrance of the most intolerable to us. The remembrance of the most grievous unto us, the burden of the most intolerable. And the problem with it is the older you get, more grievous and intolerable the thing becomes. And you just feel that it's too serious to be treated as it largely is. Can I say one thing here which is increasingly central to me? There is a collect in the prayer which you'll be familiar with, a God who art the author of peace, lover of concord, in knowledge of whom standeth our eternal life, whose service is perfect freedom. Defend us, thy humble servants, of all sorts of our enemies, that we, surely trusting in thy defense, may not fear the power of any adversaries. It seems to me that that single prayer is, as it were, the glowing remaining core of what matters. Whose service is perfect freedom? But the only freedom we really have is in truly understanding what it is that we ought to do. Which isn't, as far as I know, a biblical sentiment. I think it may be St. Augustine, but at the moment I heard it for the first time as an adult, I must have heard it hundreds of times as a child, it passed me by. But the moment I heard it for the first time as an adult seeking a return to the church, I thought, good heavens. And it's left me almost breathless ever since.
I think St. Augustine resonates with that frequently. I mean, there's that wonderful passage in the Confessions when he talks about, oh, beauty, so old and so new, late have I sought you. And then this wonderful poetry about his mistake in seeking the divine in the external, the political, the sensual, and so on, but actually discovering God in the depths of his soul. But I mean, it's absolutely in the Gospels, but it's rooted too in Christian experience and tradition.
Which is why any political discussion of religion is rather difficult, because building a bridge between those two things is extremely hard, I think.
Well, of course you're right, and I don't this explains your perfectly sensible reluctance to credit an Italian politician with more moral fibre than she's yet earned. But nonetheless, I to go back to her for a moment, we can walk with fellow travellers sometimes, and if some of those fellow travellers are braver than our own leaders in articulating a hierarchy of values that are more congruent with those of Christ and the Gospel, we can take some comfort from them, can't we?
Well, you possibly can, but you're free to do so. I've always been very struck with the warning in the Psalms, put not
your trust in princes. Yes. Well, let's agree then, not to put our trust in princes, but instead to put it in the Gospel. Peter, it's been such a delight to talk to you, and it's wonderful to hear someone speaking with such clarity and integrity. And so for those of us who are inclined to be over-seduced by the glittering promises of politicians when they stray into the ethical and the existential, you've offered us a warning. And thank you too for backing up Rod Dreher's realistic and gritty analysis of what's to come. We're going to have to find a great deal more courage than we've found in the past if we're going to live what's coming towards us with integrity.
Well, let's hope we can get it.
Yes, indeed.
Well, it's great, the great farewell of Mr. Valiant for Truth. My sword I leave to him who will succeed me in my pilgrimage, and my courage to him that can get it. Remember it?
Vaughan Williams set the most wonderful setting of those words in his opera, The Pilgrim's Progress. So both Bunyan's words and Vaughan Williams' music provide a splendid setting to that. Well, that's a marvellous way of ending. Peter Hitchens, thank you very much for joining us. God bless you, and thank you for the conversation. Thank you.